Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A year ago today, the WHO declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. A couple of weeks later, we talked with Sherry Turkle, and here's part of what she said.
I'm booked. Everybody is booked. We're connecting more than ever. I'm Zooming all day. I have meetings. I have sub-meetings. I have teaching. I have office hours. I have faculty meetings. I have curricula meetings of the meetings. I mean, I'm working on a book. I have meetings with my editor. I have meetings about the illustrations. I mean, what's very interesting about this time is that, in a way, I would almost say there's a ramping up of a kind of connection, and yet we feel more alone than ever before.
So that was Sherry Turkle a year ago. She's with us back on the show now. Hello, Professor Turkle.
I sound on speed. Those were very early days of the pandemic. Oh, yes.
You were having meetings about meetings.
Those were the early times. Yes, yes.
You're absolutely describing all of our lives.
Oh, yeah. You know, really, that it's so interesting. It's like opening a time capsule. I really appreciated your starting there. I wasn't on drugs, but I was, you know, it was like I was so disoriented. And I think we all were.
Yeah.
That we sort of overcompensated. And I do sound in an altered state, I would really have to say.
Well, you were, though. Weren't we all in an altered state that has since become the norm? I mean, in that same period of time, every single one of my days, including on top of the meetings of the meetings, was filled with, like, is our pantry full in case we all have to go on, like, quarantine? Whatever the kid's going to do.
I was scrounging for, in addition, I was, like, making forays out for toilet and Clorox, and I decided I needed hydrogen peroxide. This was a very high priority for me because my grandmother used hydrogen peroxide for all purposes, and I decided that this was going to be my way out.
Yeah.
Was hydrogen peroxide. And so I was like, well, other people were seeking Clorox, I was seeking hydrogen peroxide, which was of course impossible to find, but it was I was searching. I was on a worldwide quest. But yes, I was young then. I'm older now. I'm a different woman.
I will share my COVID stories here with you because your hydrogen peroxide quest. I mean, I will admit to you and the world that there was a time in those early weeks where I was on my WhatsApp group for our kids' schools, and we would all swap links about, like, what office supply store had cleaning supplies or toilet paper. And once I got, like, the last box of toilet paper from an office supply store, it arrived at our front door, and my husband looked at me and he was like, "Now this has gone too far."
Well, one of my funniest COVID stories is I was doing the illustrations for the book that's just come out, The Empathy Diaries. And of course, one of the most important illustrations in the book, is a beautiful photograph of my grandmother's best dishes. You know, the dishes were her Passover dishes and her Rosh Hashanah dishes and her, you know, her, the dishes for, you know, any special occasion. And these were, I talk about evocative objects, and I wanted to illustrate them by showing a beautiful picture of my grandmother's dishes. So I took, since I couldn't it was COVID and I couldn't get a photographer. I took a picture with my iPhone. Well, this wasn't going to make it into, you know, it was supposed to be the color. In fact, the dishes are the color illustration. And so I found my daughter's wedding photographer, you know, and masked. We all had a photo shoot of my grandmother's dishes. It was really, intense.
Yeah. Well, so your publisher right now is giving you a big gold star for actually properly introducing your book. So let me give you the proper introduction. So this is Sherry Turkle. She's been on the show several times before. She's a professor at MIT in the program of Science, Technology, and Society, the director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and the Self, and has written extensively for years about technology, empathy, humanity, and her latest book is The Empathy Diaries, a memoir. So we'll make your publisher happy by saying that, but it's also a terrific book. So tell me a little bit more about, I mean, we're laughing now, which I think is really healthy, and I'm glad we're able to do it, but you struggled, though. What were your struggles? Did you in the early weeks and months of the pandemic?
Yes, and that's why I think that the clip of me is so telling, because I sound, you know, I have that kind of I don't want to diagnose myself too much, but I mean I have a kind of manic, high pitched, almost anxious tone because I was struggling so much. I was very depressed. I went from being I'm over 65, and if you were over 65, you may remember, I went from being kind of, you know, fit and healthy and young to being, you know, going from like soul cycle to most likely to be intubated. Oh. You know, I kind of, you know, sort of like being defined as, you know, most likely to really be sick if you caught it. You know, just in those early days, the over 65 was kind of like, and then the death sentence for people over 65. And I was so taken aback. I was, you know, the idea that I just would stay in, and I live in a high rise, and some people in my building got sick, and the elevator was for one person at a time. And, you know, they take your car, but the valets park your car, and then they sort of, then they instructed you to start to wipe your car down with Lysol or hydrogen peroxide when you got into your car again. I became extremely anxious with all of this. And so much so that and I was teaching and trying to kind of keep up a good face for my students who I was seeing on Zoom, which I found, well, we can talk about that. I found that very difficult. And I escaped to, when it was still very cold, I escaped to a writer's cottage I have at the beach, which was not heated. But I went with my daughter and her husband. And for the first time in my life, I let my daughter take care of me in the sense of little things like, mommy, it's dinner time, soup is ready. I mean, just those little things, you know, that means that there's somebody else who's like there for you. And that made a tremendous difference to me. And it really settled me down.
Yeah.
Just that feeling that I was not alone. Yeah. And once I kind of settled down, I was fine. And then she and her husband kind of took off on their adventures after a while. And then I was fine. But I really admit that I think it was the first time in my life that I was really thrown and came to understand my own, you know, kind of my limitations of resourcefulness.
Yeah. Well, there's
that
so,
I really,
well,
there's so, yeah.
I just want to say there's so much going on there in what you just described. First of all, you're not an anxiety prone person. And to have those feelings of, like you said, anxiety well up in you, that in and of itself is enough of a challenge. But then what you just talked about was in normal times, something that that every parent-child relationship goes through, that moment of role reversal almost, yes. which likely is slower in quote-unquote normal times. But this one, it just like happened at high speed. I mean, what was that like being sort of on the – experiencing that role reversal? It sounds like you got comfort out of it.
I did. Okay. I got – well, it was almost like an intimation of what it would be like to be a much – you know, to be older. Yeah. And when that will come naturally. I mean, here it came unnaturally because I'm fit and independent and not really ready to be taken care of in that way. And yet I needed it then. Mm-hmm. So it was a very it was an interesting intimation of something that does come at a stage of life. But it came, you know, it kind of came and went at a point when I could sort of almost look at it and say, well, this is happening out of order. You know, this is happening when I'm young enough to observe it because it's happening for this reason. And my daughter is stepping up. Mm-hmm. And that's really a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
So I think that it gave me an appreciation of her that really has been very precious to me, and I think to both of us.
Well, I mean, your book is called The Empathy Diaries, and your area of research, again, for years has been about empathy and technology. We'll talk about the screens and tech part a little bit later in the show, but in the minute that we have before our first break here, how did that experience that you went through, did it change or enhance, or what impact did it have on your understanding of empathy and its importance?
Well, I think that I think the pandemic has made me realize that I've been right all along, that empathy is the key to our ability to appreciate other, you know, to really get the most out of life. Hmm. Because, you know, I had to be able to, in order to not be panicked by what I was going through, I had to have a kind of empathy for myself, a kind of self-compassion. Mm-hmm. And in order to appreciate what she could give me, I had to have an understanding of her.
Yeah.
And so for that to happen, it required empathy on both sides.
Well, we're talking to Sherry Turkle this hour about empathy and this pandemic year. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A year ago today, the WHO declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. So we're looking back at this pandemic year and specifically with the question of what have we learned about the importance of empathy in terms of holding together human society. And I'm joined today by Sherry Turkle. She's a professor at MIT, author of many books on technology and humanity. She's the director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and the Self, and her latest book is The Empathy Diaries, a memoir. And we got a lot of stories from listeners about their pandemic year, Professor Terkel. For example, Judy from Maine left us this voicemail about her experience living as a widow without family nearby over the past year.
There are many people like me, and I think the lesson for most of us is that we have come to learn the importance of community, of the community in helping us and connecting with us, but the importance of us making a point of being part of that community.
Judy, thank you for that voicemail. Now, Professor Terkel, if I can, we got a lot of voicemails on this, and I want to bring in someone who left us a voicemail, but I'm actually going to bring them on the show live because their story is quite amazing. So this is Zach Bodwin from Angola, New York. Zach, are you there?
I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Hello, and welcome to this space with me and Sherry Terkel. And Professor Terkel, feel free to jump in anytime. But Zach, a year ago today, where were you?
So I was driving to Rockville, Maryland from New York City because my brother said New York's going to break out with COVID. And then I arrived in Rockville, Maryland with COVID. and that started my, the change of my life.
You had it when you arrived in Maryland?
So I didn't have symptoms until that evening when I arrived at my brother's, and he had symptoms as well. And so we both went through it together.
Wow. And I understand that you had to leave New York City. It was the epicenter of the COVID pandemic in the United States, but mm-hmm. B, for your own health status, you had concerns.
Yeah. So I have an autoimmune that mm-hmm. has caused a lot of other problems, and so we just thought that was the best choice for me. Obviously, I still caught it, but
yeah.
Okay.
And you know what? I'm determined to bring more good news, real good news onto this show. It's one of the lessons I've learned this past year. So mm-hmm. So that was a year ago today. And what did you do today, right now? What did you do?
So I woke up at 5 a.m. and drove 2.5 hours to Syracuse to get my vaccine so I can work in my car while I wait for my appointment. And I'm super excited. Can't wait to get it. I've been looking forward to this since we found out we could get vaccines.
Wow. Okay. So everybody, a year ago, that's the, Zach's year has just been bookended there by having to leave New York City a year ago today and getting the vaccine today. That is fantastic, Zach. Okay. So what did you learn in those intervening 364 days?
So I will tell you, when I was moving to New York City, my father dropped me off at the airport and said, "You'll be back." And I said, I'm going to live in New York City and I'm never looking back. But this past year has brought me home. It's like Plato's cave. I had to go out to see the world before I could come back and really appreciate it. And I've started using my photography to raise awareness to some of the issues in rural America. And, my heart is just much more open to these communities and these people. And I just think that it's been such a paradigm shift for me.
Tell me more about that. Go ahead. How does that feel? And what exactly really shifted in you?
So, when I came back, I was kind of restless. And so I started, taking photography in nature and going through the rural communities to find things. And I started seeing how there was these falling down buildings and there was these people who were, at these places working every day. And I started to, try to get their stories and try to understand them a little bit better. I started reading more about issues within rural America. And I think that it made me want to I have a master's in conflict resolution. Mm-hmm. And it made me want to invest in these communities and try to not only listen but tell their stories and try to raise awareness to, the issues that all of the diversity that's in rural America is facing.
Yeah. So it sounds like, if I could just use really broad brush here, sounds like you have generated a much deeper well of empathy for your fellow Americans who live in rural America than maybe you had before.
Yeah. And, having an autoimmune and I'm not able to do everything physically that people do in rural America. And so I had to go out to kind of see how I could play a role in these communities as well, because, you know, it's not always as easy with a person with a disability to, you know, find a job that doesn't make my life even harder.
All right. Well, so what is your, I mean, what is your final thought for listeners who are hearing this, Zach? Like, what do you want them to know about how you're looking at the world moving forward now into this next year? Yeah.
So, you know, we're past the election, but I think that, you know, something that's really helped me is to get past the headlines. You know, like the people that you're talking about as Republicans or Democrats or rural America or urban America, like I was a rural person in New York City, right? And then I'm being grouped as an urban person, but we all have the same needs. And so I think that we really need to be more compassionate and move past the headlines and try to understand, you know, these people that are suffering and need help.
Mm. Well, that is Zach Bodwin, an On Point listener from Angola, New York. Zach, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your story.
Yep, it's been an honor.
And also congratulations on that vaccine. It's a great way to bookend the year.
Thank you. Can't wait.
All right. Well, we I'm pulling back the curtain on this whole show today. Technology is not being our friend, so we've lost our line to Professor Sherry Turkle. We're trying to get her back here. And while we do that, though, let's move on to the next guest that we had lined up for this hour, Michael Yassa, professor and Chancellor's Fellow of Neurobiology and Behavior at the University of California, Irvine, and director of the UC Irvine Center for the Neurobiology of Learning and Memory. Professor Yassa, welcome to you.
Thank you, Megan. Great to be here.
So, we're focusing on empathy for this hour, and I'll return to that focus in a second. But of course, a building of empathy is an ideal state for us to be in. But the additional truth about this pandemic year is that it has been one of profound and chronic stress for millions of people for all sorts of different reasons, right? For health reasons, because they're grieving the loss of a loved one, because of the economic catastrophe that has befallen so many Americans, let alone, you know, so the concept of this being a global pandemic, so it's hard to escape the ever-present reality of it. So let's just start there with you, if we could. What are the effects of that kind of prolonged and chronic stress on the human brain, on people?
Yeah, so the effect is really quite profound, because it's an accumulation of many, many different stressors. And we can say that it affects different people differently depending on the load that they're carrying. So some might have more life stressors than others. Some may have suffered more economic hardship than others. So you can expect the response in the brain to vary. But in general, the unifying theme is that our brains are very well adapted to deal with acute stresses. So whenever we have things that are short term, that have a certain time delimited nature, and then they go away, our brains can handle that just fine. But whenever the stress is prolonged and it becomes chronic, it really can wreak havoc on brain systems. And it's this persistent increase in a chemical called cortisol, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And that persistent increase in cortisol can start to reshape brain circuitry, reshape the connections among brain cells in two particular areas that we have been studying and others have been studying. One is the hippocampus, which is an area that's involved in learning and memory. And the other one is our prefrontal cortex, which is this big swath of cortex that allows us to make decisions, that allows us to attend to experience, to be flexible in our thinking. So you can imagine that the impact of impacting those two areas of the brain can cause real cognitive deficits.
Well,
People are reporting.
Let me just jump in here. So let's actually focus one at a time on those different systems, because I'll just use myself as an example here.
Sure.
I honestly feel that this year my working memory really diminished quite dramatically. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't tell if it was just like my advancing age, because, you know, I'm not in my 20s or even 30s anymore, or if it was because just the sheer amount of information I feel like I have to hold at any one time is more than I was capable of, or if it was because of the pandemic. So how exactly am I imagining it or not? Like, is there such thing as a pandemic memory brain here?
You're not imagining it. I think this is a fairly typically reported phenomenon. And I will say that it's not just the pandemic. Keep in mind, a lot of things happened around the same time. We had a lot of uncertainty related to the political climate. We obviously have a lot of economic hardship that's going on in the country. We have the uncertainty and worry about being infected, the social isolation, the loneliness, all of the shifts that we've had in our rhythms. That's caused an anxiety, worry, depression, sleep loss, even physical activity levels have gone down. So all of these things are conspiring together to create this really nasty situation for the brain. So working memory loss is something that has been actually quite frequently reported. People have thought about this and talked about this as almost like a brain fog.
Yeah.
A feeling like you're just not functioning at 100%. It's hard to put your finger on exactly what's going on because it's a much more general phenomenon. But it really is the accumulation of all of those stressors together.
I mean, I've experienced it in all sorts of different ways. One way in which... if you asked me today on Thursday, hey, Meghna, what was the topic of the show that you hosted on Point on Monday or Tuesday? There are many days in which I would give you a blank stare because I simply could not remember. I mean,
I sympathize.
It's a very disconcerting feeling.
Sure.
Thinking that there's entire portions of your recent life that you're just not, you do no longer have access to. So what exactly is changing in the brain? What's causing that fog?
Well, one of the things that is really important for us in the brain to always be active is our capacity to learn and remember new information. And that's what engages this hippocampus system mostly, and the prefrontal cortex as well. But its ability to kind of store incoming information, new experiences, and place them in the brain so that we can recall them later, that's what gets compromised. So this system that is highly vulnerable to stress... is getting impacted by all of these stressors. And as a result, its ability to store those new sources of information that are coming in is compromised. So, you know, one question that I get a lot is, are these things going to be lost forever? Mm-hmm. Am I ever going to be able to kind of piece them back and remember them? And it's a tough question to answer, but if it's a deficit in the learning of those and the storage of those experiences, likely not. Likely they're, you know, if you've forgotten a lot of things, they may not come back. Now, that said, if somebody reminds you of what you, you know, of what you talked about on Monday's show, likely some things will come back. But there may be some details that were just missed during the learning that they're not recoverable.
I don't know how I feel about what you just said, Professor.
Yes. I know it's doom and gloom. I know. I have some positive things to say, too.
Okay. Well, hang on here for a second, because I think we have Professor Sherry Turkle back. Terrific. Professor Turkle, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I'm sorry that we lost you for so long there. But let's try to see if we can bring your two worlds here together. What do you think about what Professor Yasa has been saying about how the stresses, the cumulative stresses of all the things, not just health-related, but economic and society-related that we've been having that have produced effects in the brain, how does that sort of work into your research on empathy? What's your response to that?
Well, I think he's right. I think we all sense that something has changed and we don't quite know what to name it. We don't know quite what it is. And I think it contributes to a kind of generalized anxiety about going back to normal life. I think that you're beginning to see now a kind of both the sort of excitement about the world picking up and also an anxiety because we don't quite know who we are as we go back to normal life. And I think that part of that is that sense that we've been you could say altered in some way, but you could also say that we've been made more vulnerable in some way, and we're not quite sure who we are as we return. So, for example, I'll give you just an anecdote. I mean, you talk about little memory loss things. I went to get my second shot the other day, and it was in this giant kind of, you know, Fenway Park Convention Center, so many people. And it was really like, I hadn't been with that many people.
Uh-huh.
Ever. And everybody was kind of had the same experience. I mean, that sense of this is too many people. You know, this is something I'm not used to navigating anymore. And you could see people, you know, who would only a year ago would have been used to kind of knowing how to place their bodies and move their bodies, were absolutely feeling kind of holding themselves very stiffly, their arms at their side, yeah. Really not knowing how to do this. And I think there are so many ways in which we're coming out very gingerly and nervously into this new world.
Well, so Professor Yasa, let me turn back to you. We've just got a minute before our next break here. Yeah. But I think what Professor Turkle is talking about is spot on. And is there actually a neurobiological factor to this? Like that there's things that the brain, no matter how plastic it is, doesn't want to unlearn.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Sherry is spot on. In fact, I would say that it took a while for us to be able to adapt to the pandemic normal, to adapt to the isolation. And now we are trying to change that rhythm again. And I think we're all very excited about, being able to return back to normal life. But, you know, it's really quote unquote normal. We're not really sure what that new baseline is going to look like. And so many things have changed. And it's going to take some time for our brains to be able to adapt back to whatever this new normal is. And I think there's a lot of anxiety around that. I've certainly felt it myself.
Mm. Well, we are talking this hour about this past pandemic year. And I'm joined today by Sherry Turkle. Her new book is The Empathy Diaries, a memoir. Michael Yasa joins us as well. He's a professor of neurobiology at the University of California, Irvine. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next week on the show, we're going to talk about the red hot housing market and how the housing market has been incredibly tight in this pandemic year. So who's benefiting from that? Because homeownership, long a sort of central pillar of achieving the American dream. But there's some folks now, including the CEO of Redfin, who say the housing market is so tight, housing may now be turning into a luxury good. So what do you think about that? Have you been trying to get that foothold in a starter house anywhere in the United States? What has that been like? Give us a call at 617-353-0683. 617-353-0683. We'll be talking about the housing market next week on the show. Today, we are looking back at this pandemic year and asking what we've learned about ourselves and about society. I'm joined today by Sherry Turkle. She's author of the book The Empathy Diaries, a memoir. Mike Yasa joins us as well. He's a neurobiologist at the University of California, Irvine. And I just wonder if the two of you could listen along with me for one second to some reflections we received from an epidemiologist whom we turned to several times over this past year, Sasia Popescu. She is an infectious disease specialist in Phoenix, Arizona. And she told us that for the past 12 months, they've been nothing short of
exhausting. We spent our lives trying to prevent something like this from happening. And then seeing it unfold in real time is mind-boggling.
And Saskia has long been one of those people who, in her words, keeps going and doesn't stop. So she was kind of surprised that the pandemic taught her the benefits of pressing pause.
Taking that time to whether it's exercise or read something that's not COVID related, sit outside, you know, with my husband and have a coffee, those quiet moments, I absolutely had to force myself to do that. And I think that was a big learning moment, because it was just like, okay, if I don't invest in myself and take care of myself, I don't know how effective I can be in response.
And she says that the pandemic has also been like a scouring pad, abrading away gauzy myths and convenient presumptions about whole societies, specifically the society she lives in.
I think it's really revealed a few things. The first is that we are very prone to politicize things, and that kind of partisanship can be very damaging, especially in an emergent situation. You know, I also really think that this has continued to shed light on a lot of disparities that exist that, you know, we really truly have known about, but it's made it, frankly, so apparent that unless we really start to address them, you know, we can't move forward.
That's epidemiologist Sasia Popescu. Now, Mike Yasa and Sherry Turkle, I have a question that I'd love to hear through, like, both your lenses here, like just your basic take on what this pandemic year has revealed to us about, you know, who we are as people, as humans. And Mike Yasa, how would you answer that?
So I have a couple of responses to that. I think that it's revealed a number of things about who we are. One, I think it's revealed our vulnerability, and to really show that we can be impacted as a society so heavily by this pandemic that it impacts every facet of our lives. It exposed the real vulnerability that that I think we were very unprepared for. The other two things are interestingly kind of a contrast, because I do think that the stress of the pandemic coupled with all of the other stressors has almost had a tendency to reveal some of the uglier sides of our society and some of the better sides of our society. So it almost amplifies our differences a little bit. And we've seen great stories of heroism, you know, frontline healthcare workers, people that are really interested in helping others and uplifting others. And we've seen other stories where people were denigrating each other and politicizing things and making it really about their selfish purposes. So I think it's accentuated a lot of the contrasts that that might have always been there, but maybe we didn't pay too much attention to. But now they just came to the forefront.
Mm-hmm. Sherry Turkle, how would you answer that?
Well, she brings up a really interesting point that anthropologists talk about. They talk about the power of stepping away from your society and seeing it as a stranger, kind of decountrifying yourself. And almost seeing your own society as though you were a stranger, seeing it for the first time, seeing it revealed. And I think Americans have had that experience. We've watched ourselves on television, and we've seen things that we've known about, but that we haven't been willing to see because they're so painful. The inequalities of income, the racism, the sexism, we've seen it, the frightening divisions. And we've seen it played out as though it were a movie that we knew existed, but we really didn't believe. And I think there's both, the downside of that, but also the hopefulness of that, because it's only by finally stepping out of the 4th of July parade and seeing those things that we can move forward. Mm-hmm. And empathy begins, you know, not by saying, I know how you feel, but by saying, tell me how you feel. I don't know how you feel.
And then listening.
And I think we're ready to do that, and then listening. And more than listening, really saying, I'm not just going to listen to you, but I'm going to make a commitment to stick with you and be with you and try to rebuild this country. So I think that, you know, there's an upside to this terrible downside, a possibility in this kind of stepping aside and seeing ourselves as though from afar. And that is what I hear in those remarks.
But Professor Turkle, can I just jump here? Because I struggle. Here's one thing that I struggle with. I have been privileged by virtue of being host of this program, to have had firsthand experiences of individuals being extremely empathetic with each other, right? Like they were willing to do that in their own lives and in the space of this show. But then very quickly, there seems to be a gap between that capacity for individual empathy, say neighbor to neighbor, and then the gap between that and a society that is empathetic, yes, that creates empathetic policies. That is a gap that we have not bridged yet. Is that even possible?
Yes, that's our next challenge, because I think we've used empathy as a tagline. Mm-hmm. You know, political. I mean, every political convention, it was like that's the new thing to say. You know, every political gauzy ad, that's the word. But really, empathy is hard. I'm arguing for an empathy that's very difficult. It's not just I want to put myself in your place. It's I want to put myself in your problem. I want to make a commitment to you and listening to you, not because I think I know what you feel, but because I don't know what you feel. I'm here to not just listen, but really, you know, stick with you for the duration, because we have to rebuild this country. I see how bad it is, and we really have to get together and rebuild this country. I see empathy as a kind of new civic responsibility, not just a new personal responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so I think we haven't made that next step. I think that's really, that's the new agenda.
Mike Yasa, is there a kind of biological tribalism that prevents that, that prevents that next step that Sherry Turkle's talking about that entire societies could take?
This is exactly where I was going to go, Meghna. I mean, I think that empathy, I completely agree with Sherry that I think empathy is the solution. The problem is, in times of hardship, it's very difficult to think outside of your circle. It's very difficult to think outside of your immediate family, your immediate community, and their needs. So there's a limitation on the empathy that you be able to provide, the compassion that you be able to provide for others, that is a function of what you're going through. And I do think that there's something deeply biological about that. Obviously, we've all adapted to help each other within some circles to be able to survive. But I don't know if the overall desire to be empathic and compassionate with others would, you know, trump the biological need to support those in my immediate circle. So I think there's almost a biological rationale against it. But that said, it is the solution, because as a society, we will not survive without it. Mm-hmm. So the question, maybe redirected back at Sherry, is how do you reinforce that message? How do you make it so that everybody feels that civic responsibility extend beyond their immediate circle?
Well, I think one of the things you need to do, first of all, and this has already come up in the area of sort of saving the earth, I mean, to move us away for a moment from, you know, politics, is when younger people become convinced that they're not going to have an earth unless they think of themselves, you know, kind of as a group of people who are one, because if they are not one, well, they will, their generation will not have an earth to live on, a sustainable planet. You begin to see the beginnings, I think, of what that might look like when people truly believe that. And I think that you can see when you work with people around issues of, you know, will there be water? Will there be air? What will happen if the seas rise? With people who are kind of open to considering really, you know, the data on that, I think you begin to see a glimmer of what that would look like as people begin to define the tribe mm-hmm. more globally.
Mm. So, Mike Yasa, how do you respond to that?
I really like what Sherry just said in terms of being able to extend this circle and thinking about it in terms of global challenges. And I do think that the glimmer of hope that I see is really the younger generation, as she said. I think that's really where we need to concentrate and focus our efforts. Think about that in our educational systems, in our communication, in our outreach, because they are much more concerned about the fate of the world than I think many of us are. And you know, they have their head in the right place. And with that logic, thinking about those global challenges that need to be addressed as a planet, this much more collectivist thinking, I think, will espouse a lot more compassion and empathy.
Mm-hmm. You know, I started the hour by asking Professor Terkel how this past year had been for her. Mike Yasa, I should have actually started when you came out of the show to ask you that same question. How, in your individual experience, what has this past year been like?
You know, it's funny. I was hearing Sherry talk about, you know, her manic experience early in the pandemic, and I completely related to that. It was so busy. Everything shifted over to Zoom. It was meetings upon meetings upon meetings. It took a while to figure out how to build a rhythm. But I will say, I mean, it felt like it wasn't going to last this long. Like, we just needed to kind of hunker down for a couple of months and then all will be open again. So the longer that it dragged on, I think the more it started to kind of sink in. I really need to change my life and build rhythms in a way that I wasn't accustomed to before. And I still struggle with that to some extent. I mean, I still have meetings upon meetings upon meetings. But building in the breaks, building in some new rhythms, making sure that there's time to, you know, sleep and exercise and have some, you know, outdoor time and all of those things, I think is critical.
Yeah. Professor Terkel, I'm going to come back to you in one second, but gosh, you know, today I'm going to openly embrace my all over the place-ness. There's one thing that, Mike, that I want to ask you about when we were talking about different systems of the brain that feel an impact after prolonged stress. We had talked about memory and working memory, but you were also mentioning the prefrontal cortex. And the reason why I wanted to come back to that for a second is we've mentioned young people kind of here and there in this hour, but the prefrontal cortex in young people isn't fully developed, right? Not until, what, in the mid-20s at least, we talk about.
That's right.
So what has this year of prolonged pandemic stress, what impact has it had on them in particular and their still developing brains?
Yeah, your guess is as good as mine, because I don't think we have the long-term data to be able to tell whether brains have rewired, you know, somewhat permanently. I mean, I do think that their brains are still quite adaptive and resilient, and it's possible that some of these effects will be temporary. But by the other token, I would say that it's an opportunity that the brains are still developing and there's still pliability and opportunities for change. So any positive things that they've experienced during this time with respect to empathy, compassion, advocacy for social justice, those are good things to wire the prefrontal cortex with.
Mm. Well, with that, Sherry Terkel, here's what I'm going to do. I would like you
to... Is this a lightning round?
No, it's not. In fact, I'm going to do something different. We're going to take advantage of the fact that we have a podcast feed. So I'm going to talk to you separately about the Empathy Diaries and about tech and this past year. We're going to put that in the podcast feed. So I promise everyone that's going to happen. But for now, for this hour, I'm going to wrap up by saying Sherry Terkel is a professor at MIT. And again, her new book is The Empathy Diaries, a memoir. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Terkel.
My pleasure.
And Mike Yasa, professor and Chancellor's Fellow of Neurobiology and Behavior at the University of California, Irvine. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to wrap up by giving voice to some of On Point's listeners who've been sending us feedback over this hour. For example, Justin Wilson says, hands down, the most testing year of my life. I'm an essential worker in a region that did not take the pandemic seriously. Silver lining, though, core family unit grew closer, displayed a strength I'm so proud of. I'm hoping the world's love prevails over selfishness. Well, on that point of love, Denise from Iowa sent us this voicemail.
For me personally, it's made me a lot more patient and a lot more understanding or forgiving of people's behavior, because if anything, I learned that we don't know what's going on in each other's lives, each other's homes, and we need to give each other a lot more grace. So lead with love. That's pretty much what I learned and how I have changed.
Thank you so much for that, Denise. We still want to hear from all of you about your pandemic year. Call us at 617-353-0683 or hop on Facebook and Twitter. We're at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.